This morning is a difficult, well, not a difficult lesson. It's a lesson that I don't enjoy because it's a subject that's not the greatest to me. And I used to wait to the very latest to teach this subject right before Augustine because I had to teach it, but I don't really like it. And it's the subject of monasticism and the whole rise of monasticism and the monastic movement in the church. But I've decided to teach it today because this is where it follows in the text by Professor Gonzalez. And I'm going to try to do the lectures from now on pretty much on the order that he does his chapters because I think it just makes more sense. I wish I had emailed that to you earlier in the week. I didn't. Some of you might have read it anyway. So that's where we are. And I will email you tonight or tomorrow the chapters for next week. But it's going to be the next three chapters out of Gonzalez. I'm just going to flip him a little bit, I think. Anyway, this morning we're coming to the subject of monasticism and the spread of Christianity. Now, if you know anything of monasticism, you think of a monastic as moving out of society, being alone or with a group of people. How in the world could monasticism actually spread Christianity? Well, I think it did in certain parts of the universe, and we will get to that in the last 10 minutes of the lesson this morning. But for the first 10 minutes, the first part of the lesson, let's just talk about the issues of monasticism. Monasticism was a response to pressures on the church. The church always has pressures. It always had pressures. It had pressures from Pentecost, right after that with Stephen. It has pressures today. As long as the Lord doesn't return, the church will have pressures. Pressures from outside, pressures from inside. How does the church respond to pressures? We'll see it through the centuries that sometimes it responds in a way, I think, that really gives glory to the Lord. Sometimes it responds in a way that doesn't give glory to the Lord. Most of the time, it responds in a way that both gives glory and not mixed together. There are virtually no clear examples of perfect response to pressure found in the 21 centuries of the church. There's not one today. There hasn't been one. And we need to get it out of our heads that anybody really responded to pressures just perfectly. Some did better, some did worse. No one did it perfectly. Well, let's see how these brethren did it in the 3rd and 4th and 5th century. Backgrounds of monasticism. I was going to show you a new listing of titles of periods. You know how we did our other chart, which said that we're in the early church period, etc. Someone has given a chart on the ages of the church. The age of Jesus and the apostles, you see they put from 30 to 70. The age of the early Christianity from 70 up to 303, which is the great persecution, began. The age of the Christian empire, which is the age that we're in, obviously, today in the period that we're teaching, would go up to the first pope. Then you have the Christian Middle Ages, up to the time of the Reformation, the age of the Reformation, the age of reason and revival, the age of progress, the age of ideologies, 1914 to the present. Of course, all of this is next year. No, but next year beginning next fall. Today, dealing with monasticism, we're in the age of the Christian empire. Last week we talked about the very fact that with the conversion of Constantine and religion becoming religio licentia, it was a licensed religion. It was legal to be a Christian. We then begin to see a marrying of the church and state that will happen for a number of centuries. It is the pressure, to some degree, begins to come off the church. The pressure of martyrdom has come off to a degree. It becomes fashionable to be a Christian in some circles. This is the age of the Christian empire, the spread of Christianity by the sword and by other things. Monasticism itself, when you talk about monasticism and religious history, there are two strains for monasticism. There's an Oriental strain. Asceticism was to be found among the Hindus before the time of Alexander the Great. The Vedas and the laws of the Menu in the 7th century BC teach full asceticism. Hindu monks who were called gymnosophites, which literally means naked philosophers, were as wild in their practices as the pillar saints of the Eremitic monastic period, which we'll speak about later. Not only do you have an Oriental influence, you have a Hellenistic influence. This influence was not as great as the Oriental, but the Pythagoreans resembled a monastic society. Well, the backgrounds of monasticism in religious history, but the backgrounds of monasticism in philosophical reason. Where does the philosophy come from, or what philosophy is it that can be the seedbed of monasticism? Pagan philosophy can be a part of this, because in pagan philosophy you have the Gnostic dualism, saying that the matter is evil, only the spirit is good. Okay, if matter is evil, if we remove ourselves from the most matter we can, then we can get to the most good. So this kind of dualism exists in there. Catholic Christian monasticism. By that, let me read my statement, it's better. This arises from the conflict between the spirit and the flesh. The former, the Catholic Church, has exerted influence on the latter to the degree that the latter, in many cases, becomes indistinguishable from the former. If you talk about monasticism, you're talking about, in your mind, really Catholic monasticism, because they become intertwined. And you think of monasticism as being always a part of what became recognized as the Catholic Church. Well, is there any basis for monasticism in the Scriptures? Some would say that there is a basis. Alleged biblical examples from the Old Testament, Elijah and Elisha, from the man who bridged the old and the new, John the Baptist. These were people who were ascetic, almost, putting themselves out. They even refer to examples of Christ's poverty, that he had nowhere to lay his head. They talk about the reclusiveness of Mary, who was Martha's sister. But you can answer all these alleged Bible examples by an understanding. All are either a misuse of an Old Testament example or a misinterpretation of a singular New Testament action. Now, if you find an action mentioned once, if you find a supposed doctrine mentioned once, what does the first rule of hermeneutics require you to do? Find it again, or don't make it a rule, because you cannot have a practice from one text. There is no single text that teaches a doctrine that is not supported and found somewhere else. It just doesn't exist. If you remember that first basic, it is the first rule of hermeneutics, isn't it, Paul, in a sense, to say, huh? So-called. But I mean, it has to, if you don't find it twice, you haven't found it once. That might be kind of simplistic, but I'll leave it at that. A monastic ideals conflicts, though, with the gospel, and I think you'll see this. It's not missionary in vision. Most of the cases, it's not. It tends to divide Christianity into two groups: those aspiring to perfection and those who are willing to compromise with the world, the non-perfect ones, the ones who actually were living and making a living. So, I mean, you got two classes of Christians come from this, and we will find when we do our summary later that this is one of the worst things that came from monasticism right there. Another thing that comes out of monasticism is this word, sacerdotalism. Sacerdotalism is something, a big word that we will use throughout the history of the church. Sacerdotalism simply means the elevation of a priesthood above the laity. This becomes a problem in the organized church. It remains a problem throughout the centuries of the church, and it's one of the worst problems that the Reformation answered right there. I mean, to answer justification by faith is one thing, but to answer sacerdotalism and the removal of a priesthood was a practical thing that had to be taught against, and the priesthood of the believer, all believers, had to be emphasized and taught. So sacerdotalism is something that, as a result, we can say is one of the results of the monastic movement, and obviously it's something that infected the Catholic, with a big C, church through its life. Well, there are several other reasons for the monastic movement. You can have secular reasons. Imagine this. The Roman Empire was falling apart. By the end of the 3rd century, you had the pressure coming from the Goths, the pressure coming from the Huns, the pressure from the Persians from the east. You had pressures coming against the political and organized Roman Empire. It seemed that trouble was on every hand. The intellectually and socially oriented individual had no desire to function in an unappreciative society. They tended to withdraw from it and conserve their energies. This led to the formation of seats of learning and great libraries, which we appreciate, but it was removing yourself from the culture. Economic upheavals were occurring throughout the empire. Taxation was increasing. In fact, I was reading about one of the orders that was given before the beginning of the great what we call the Great Persecution under Diocletian, was that the Christians, their taxes were doubled. And they said, okay, you can still be a Christian, but you're going to have to pay double tax. And they got the bishop and said that the bishop was going to have to collect this tax from his people. Well, you know, the bishop's answer to that was no. And the people's answer to that was no. And so the result of that was increased persecution and great persecution. In fact, it didn't happen under the time of Diocletian. It happened under the time of the Persians and the greatest persecution, which we will get to at the end of this. I got my periods wrong where that illustration came from. But it's true in the Roman Empire also. Taxation was increasing. Many felt themselves failures at home, and they sought escape. That could be a secular reason. But there were spiritual reasons, which I think was very true. As martyrdom ended, monasticism became a substitute for it. If you could not give your life literally for Christ and for the witness of the gospel, I mean, if you didn't have to give up your life, they didn't take it from you, you could voluntarily give up your life and everything good for you as a witness to the Lord. So, in a real sense, monasticism replaced martyrdom. There was also an idea and a feeling that to preserve the virginity of the early church, it had to be taken to the desert. It had to be removed from society. We'll, again, get with this when we talk about the good and bad influences. Philip Shaw says that it places the great problem of Christianity not in transformation, but in the abandonment of the world. And that was what it was attempting to do, was to abandon the world. Well, what were some of the geographical areas for monasticism? You've got the east and you've got the west. The east we think of is all of Egypt. Remember, all of Egypt now is in the west, and the east, all of Palestine, Asia Minor, Turkey, that's all considered the east. The east was the area of greatest growth of monasticism. The west, it was not as quick to gain a foothold. The cloister or cenobitic version of monasticism made its home in the west easier than the east. You have three periods of development of monastic ideals. The first period is the ascetic period. This way of life was never fully developed. The ascetic desires usually led to an eremitical lifestyle. I think I put the word anchorite up there also. Anchorite means withdrawn. You could say that the ascetic monastic was withdrawn totally from anyone, from society. The asceticism, or a degree of asceticism, remained in the lives of some of the clergy, even the clergy that functioned in the church. This is where you have the development of the celibacy. You have the development of some clergy remained very plain in their habit. Now, that habit would be a wrong word, because I don't think they were wearing habits at this time, like you could think of a habit. But in their way and manner of life, they were very plain. this asceticism in the clergy was an influence on Augustine, which I'm sure Doug will point out in January when we teach Augustine, because he felt he needed at one time to remain very plain. Also, he lived in a monastery, didn't he? To stay away from the people just because the people would overwhelm him. But anyway, the influence of asceticism continued. The hermit eremitical period of the church of monastic development is the largest and the first that you can really identify. There's two main men that are identified with this period. Well, I should define the word, shouldn't I? You had that down there, David. The eremia, or desert, a religious recluse is what this person was. One of the men that was identified with this is a guy by the name of Paul of Thebes. Again, we thank our friends in the Greek Orthodox Church for giving us their idea of what Paul of Thebes looked like. Paul is on the left, by the way, if you didn't know. Paul, around the year 250, now realize, this was before Constantine. I mean, the monastic movement did not begin after Constantine. It began before Constantine. And one of the reasons it may have, you said, well, wait a minute, the church was still under persecution. Yeah, but from about 251 after Decius until Diocletian, the church had a 50-year period of peace where there was no persecution. So you could even see that in this period, people were feeling the need to withdraw. Around 250, at the age of 22, Paul fled to the desert outside of Alexandria to escape Decian's persecution. Finding solitude to his liking, he remained in the desert for another 90 years. We know about Paul because Jerome, who was another monastic figure that we'll get to in a few minutes, wrote about Paul. He wrote a life of Paul. We wouldn't even know the man existed if Jerome had not written about him. Paul supposedly was visited by our next gentleman, whose name is Anthony. Let's go ahead and put Anthony's picture up there. Again, there's Anthony. I don't know which one's Anthony. I really wasn't able to identify it. I just was given that picture as both of them. Paul supposedly was visited by Anthony. He likened Anthony to Elijah and John. Anthony reported that for the first 60 years, Paul had been fed by a raven daily. And when Anthony went to visit, the raven brought a double portion. Go figure. These are the stories that are associated with these monastic followers. These stories were written down by honest men. I'll just leave the stories for what they were.
It looks like you should have eaten the raven.
Okay. On his second visit to Paul, Anthony found him dead. Two lions supposedly helped him dig the grave to bury Paul. Anyway, next we'll bring up Anthony. The reason we know about Anthony is because Athanasius, a very good brother, wrote the life of Anthony. Athanasius we'll talk about next week. But Anthony was born around 251, probably of well-to-do Coptic Christian parents. We'll define Coptic Christianity when we do African Christianity in a couple of weeks. At age 18, his parents died, left him with wealth and the care of his sister. When he heard the gospel story of the rich young ruler, Matthew 19 read, and the instructions of Christ to that ruler to go and sell all, he was so impressed by that charge, Matthew 19:21, that he went and sold all of his inheritance except for a small portion set aside to take care of his sister. Soon afterwards, he heard the words of Christ out of the Sermon on the Mount, read Matthew 6:34, and he sold his sister's portion. And I'm sure that sister appreciated that. Anyway, I never had a sister, but I had a daughter who was a sister, and I know what they thought of their brothers, older or younger. But anyway, Anthony sold everything, sold his sister's portion, and he goes to the desert. He took an abode outside of a village. He lived there in a secluded, eremitical life until his last years. His followers and admirers built caves near him. He died in the year 356 at the age of 105. Obviously, the ascetic lifestyle was good for some of these men. I can only say he did live that long. That is a discernible fact. As I said earlier, since Athanasius wrote his biography, we know more about him. Helen Waddell is an author who wrote a book called The Desert Fathers. The Desert Fathers contains many of the sayings of these Desert Fathers. I can read you a couple of them. She talks about Anthony, and she talks about the fact that while Anthony was removed from society, he was removed to live really by himself, he still could not get away from sin and get away from problems because he felt himself challenged by the devil and by demons. She quotes Anthony as saying, "He who sits in solitude and is quiet has escaped from three wars, hearing, speaking, and seeing. Yet against one thing he shall continually battle, that is, his own heart." Anthony realized that. The desert hermits, as they were called, often talked of being attacked by demons. This is a picture of Anthony, and these are the demons that he felt were attacking him all the time. In the monastic tradition, eight demons are identified. These demons were especially enemies of the monks. They were gluttony, sexual thoughts, love of money, grief, wrath, sloth, vainglory, and arrogance. Does anyone kind of recognize that list? What is it, Brother Lee?
Well, the seven deadly
sins. Yeah, it's eight reduced to seven, but it's the seven deadly sins are right out of this list of eight right here. I didn't go back and check the seven to see which one they left out, but they thought that they were being bombarded by these, and we know that they were being bombarded with them because they were fallen men, and they had a fallen nature, and we know that you will always be bombarded by these things. It is said that in Egypt at this time, the children played a game. Instead of playing cops and robbers, which they did when I was smaller, really we played Americans and Germans and Japanese, because I killed so many Germans and Japanese. It was legitimate to kill a man because we were post World War II. Anyway, instead of playing cops and robbers, the kids in Egypt would play demons and monks. And one of the kids would dress up in a black robe, and he would be the monk, and all the rest of the kids would be the demons, and they would afflict him, you know, "You're it," or whatever like that. I don't really know how. That's true. That is true. I got it from a good source. They played the game, demons and monks. I'll leave that alone. Take it for where it is. There were several stories from the Desert Fathers. And another story that Mrs. Waddell tells is the story of a hermit who was on a mountain. I don't know how big the mountain was, but someone went to visit him. And he asked him, was it true that with the right amount of faith that the mountain would rise? Oh, yes, he said, "How are things getting along? Do people have enough faith so that they can say to the mountain, 'Rise up and be cast into the sea'?" Well, as the monk was saying those things and asking the man the condition of the world, the mountain started to rise up. It started to rumble. It started to shake. "O mountain," said the monk, "I was not giving orders. I was just quoting the Bible. Sit down." And the mountain goes back to its normal position. So either there was a circumstantial rumbling of the mountain, there was an earthquake, I don't know what it was, but that is a story, supposedly, that even with the saying of the mountain, the monk could make the mountain rise up. Anyway, desert monks, the last one, I don't have a picture of him, but Simeon the Stylites was called a pillar saint. Simeon built first a tower of 4 cubits height, so that would only be like 6 feet high, that he got on, and he put a rail around it so that he couldn't lie down. He had to stand up the whole time. Eventually, he makes a tower 72 feet high, that he is up on top of this tower, and he stays there for, what does it say in my notes, 60 years? I don't know what it was. 36 years. He would preach from the tower, repentance. Twice a day, people would come out to the tower, and they would hear him preach. One person commented, though, that he was smart in building his tower because the Syrian mountains were behind him, and he could turn around in his tower and have a great view of the mountains. Anyway, Simeon the Stylites, if you think of hermits and think of the desert, you have to hear about Simeon. Well, what can we say? Questions about this. How can these men be held in high regard by the Roman Catholic Church when they forsook all of the means of grace offered by the church? There was no baptism, there was no communion, no Lord's Supper, no sacrament, no Eucharist. Though the piety of some hermits, for example Anthony, is to be admired, their lack of biblical basis and practice is to be deplored. That is something we could say about the hermits as a group. A third period of monasticism is called the Cenobitic period. What's a Cenobite? Cenobite is from the Greek words koinos bios, common life. Professor Schaff says it's an association of a number of anchorites or eremitics of the same sex for mutual advancement in an ascetic society. Several famous ones of these, Pachamus and the Pachamian monasteries. Pachamus was a younger contemporary of Anthony, born in 285 or 292 in Egypt, died in 346. Converted while a soldier, became a partial hermit after baptism. 325, he was directed by an angel in a vision to establish a society of monks on the island of Tabani in the Upper Nile. He didn't say that the monks would actually talk to each other that much, but the monks would live in close association. They could carry out their duties together better than apart. By the time of his death, there were 8 or 9 such cloisters with at least 3,000 members. The Pachamian monasteries, walls, whatever. Basil of Caesarea. I've heard this pronounced Basil rather than Basil. Is it more correct to say Basil? Do you think, Christy, you're an English person, you don't know. But I mean, listening to some lectures, they're talking about Basil rather than Basil. I've already been Basil, but... Yeah, well, then let's go Basil, and we'll try to stay with Basil.
From the Greek word basilion.
What's that?
It comes from, I think, the Greek word for kingdom. Isn't that not
basilion?
Basileus.
Okay, Basil. We'll call him Basil. Basil of Caesarea was a good man that we'll review later when we talk about some other things. He was a Cappadocian, which was a very good group of men in teaching about the deity of Christ. Basil visited Egypt in 358. He was impressed by the Pachamian monasteries. He sold his property, distributed money amongst the poor, and embarked on a monastic life across the river from Pontius. He left the monastic life at times, though, to enter into theological controversies of the church, even to serve as a bishop. And this is interesting, and it shows a movement between the monastic life back to the life of the church. And this is where the spread of Christianity comes from. Basil, though he approved of the monastic lifestyle, said, quote, "How can a person test his humility when he has no one to whom he can show himself the inferior? It is very hard to be humble all by yourself out in the middle of the desert. But if there are other people around, then you can be. If the Lord washed the feet of the disciples, whose feet will you wash?" That's what he was asking for the ones that said they had to remain totally alone. Basil wrote rules for monastic life, the longer rules and the shorter rules. They were very useful. They were influential in the growth of monastic life in the East and the West. Another, I'm sorry, I forgot to put Basil's picture up there. Forgive me. Now, we have a little better picture of this this brother, Martin of Tours. Martin was a soldier. He was a contemporary of Basil, though unaffected by him. He was a pioneer of the monastic movement in the West, particularly in Gaul, which we know as present-day France. While in the army, he had the experience of the coat and the beggar. He came upon a beggar completely naked. He took his sword and he cut the bottom of his own cloak off and gave half of the cloak to the beggar. Now, you can't think of cutting half of your coat off like you take half of your sport coat and cut it in two, but your cloak was a longer garment. He cut the bottom of it off. He gave it to the beggar. That night in a dream, he dreamed that Jesus came to him and restored his cloak, restored the half of it that was that he had given away. He attempted to witness to his parents. He became a hermit. He became the Bishop of Tours. He left the hermetic life and went back to the church. After his death, his biography was written by one of his disciples. It had a widespread influence in the Western monastic development. Another thing about the cloak, though, the cloak that he gave to the beggar was kept, and it was put in the church. And it's interesting, the person who was in charge with keeping the cloak was, in Latin, the capella, or the capellani, the ones who were keeping the cloak. And from this word, we get chapel, which is not church, but a less than a church is a chapel. And supposedly, the word chapel comes from the ones who were keeping the half of cloak of Martin of Tours. Whatever. That was Martin. Jerome. Do I put Jerome up? Yeah, that's a picture of Jerome. Jerome was born about 347 of Christian parents. He became a fancier of the world as a youth while studying in Rome, baptized in his mid-20s, became ascetic later in life. He later returned to Rome where he was a teacher of many of the wealthy women and a secretary to the head of the church who was called at that time Pope Damascus. He began his translation of the scriptures into Latin, called the Latin Vulgate. This supposed picture you see, he's got the scrolls in his hands. This Latin Vulgate is the, if I'm not mistaken, the text that was used to create the Greek text from that the King James was translated from. Am I not correct, Doug?
That would only be true of certain verses of Revelation.
Only certain verses of Revelation. Okay.
For the original King James, the original English version, they went back and found actual Greek text over time, but only when they didn't have the Greek text would they use the Latin text.
Okay.
The first Greek text, they take the Latin, they went back to Greek, and that came to them.
Okay.
But they went back to the Greek originally, finally, so it's better than that.
So the original 1611 KJV is certainly better than the Latin Vulgate. Yes.
It's based on Greek text.
Part of it that was based on Greek text, but part of it was based on the Latin.
Sure, that's the received text. But that came from a certain set of Greek texts.
Okay.
It also should be noted that the Latin Vulgate was a masterful translation.
Right.
The Italians were running around with dozens and dozens of different translated excerpts into the old Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mayhem. Nobody's Bible said the same thing as anyone else's Bible. Jerome gave the Western Church one Bible.
Which was useful for the next 1,000 years. Over 1,000, yeah. Very good. Well, that's Brother Jerome. I don't have any quotes from Jerome. The last era of monasticism that we'll bring up is the Benedictine era. The most lasting effect on the church came from the Benedictines. Benedict of Nursia was born around 480, studied in Rome. He became a hermit at the age of 15 or 20. Began to train young men east of Rome, where there were 12 different monasteries. In 528 or 529, he moved to Monte Cassino. That's a current-day picture of that. Not very clear, sorry about that. Which was between Rome and Naples. He destroyed a pagan temple to Apollo and established a monastery. Became very famous before his death in 542. His greatest contribution to monastic life were the rules which he developed. He called these rules were something of these. Monasticism must be self-contained and self-supporting. The abbot or the father was over the community of monasteries, possibly with other officers, a prior, a dean, etc., like that. When you read the rules, let's see, where do I have it right here? Yeah, when you read the rules of Benedict, in his preface, he says, "Therefore, we intend to establish a school for the Lord's service. In drawing up its regulations, we hope to set down nothing harsh, nothing burdensome. The good of all concerned, however, may prompt us to a little strictness in order to amend faults and safeguard love. Do not be daunted immediately by fear and run away from the road that leads to salvation. It is bound to be narrow at the onset. But as we progress in the way of life and faith, we shall run on the path of God's commandments, our hearts overflowing with expressible delight of love." Throughout these rules, which were only, I think, like 96 pages, he weaves together scripture and other things without giving scriptural quotes. He just weaves it together. And you can find some references to grace in that. But it always is grace that is exhibited by works. And that's going to be a dangerous thing. As we talk about conclusions, when you look at monasticism, you have to see good, you have to see bad. Some of the good things the monastics were men of prayer. Opus Dei, the work of God, prayer. Prayer is a good thing. And for 1,000 years, there were men and women, because there were female monastic orders, that were given to a lot of prayer every day. Just in the mail this week, I received a thing from a Benedictine monastery in Oklahoma, and it was Benedictine chants. And so I was playing it all the way over here this morning, trying to get myself in the mood, and thought of playing it for y'all. But I will tell you this, it is calming. It's calming to listen to them. You don't know what they're saying, but it are singing, but it is calming. You can't be excited listening to Benedictine monks chanting. Anyway, they were men of prayer. They had a work of learning, and good works was to be found in the monasteries. This is a good thing, because through the ages that we call the Dark Ages, which is kind of a misnomer, learning resided in the monasteries. When Patrick functioned in Ireland and England, if it had not been for Patrick and what he did and what he kept alive, all of Northern Europe would have been totally engulfed in darkness. Missions, especially in the East, are a part. We'll see the Eastern missions in a minute. But anytime you consider monasticism, you have to consider separation. Separation. Good, separation, bad. Separation is good in the fact that the monastic lifestyle rebuked the worldly spirit of Christendom, with a capital C, which was being about at this time. There was a difference in them. But it was bad in the fact that it ended up being what I would call Christ against culture. The monastic movement did not believe that you could take Christ and present him to the culture, and that Christ could influence the culture. You needed to remove from the culture. This removal has affected the church throughout its life. It affected it in the time of the Reformation, where there were movements that wanted to remove themselves totally from society. It affected the church in the 19th and 20th century with separatist fundamentalism that said we can establish and build our own culture, our own institutions. They thought they were keeping themselves pure. I guarantee you one thing, they were not affecting the culture. As someone who did an analysis of it, they said that separatist fundamentalism hardly deserves to be mentioned because it didn't affect anything. It withdrew. That's a lecture for about 2 years from now. Bad things about the monastic movement: it bred two levels of spirituality, which we mentioned earlier. The religious were the monks. The secular was everyone else. So to be religious was to be set apart, and that made you in a very special class. Soon it was thought that the religious, who were the special ones, could garner favor with God, and they had extra favor, so you could go to them to intercede even for you. They could give some of that earned grace to you because they earned it because they were religious. The other thing is salvation by works. Let me read you what Dr. Calhoun said in talking about this system of salvation by works. When you read Benedictine's rule and some of his writings by the monastics, to be fair, I think you would say that grace is not altogether missing. Benedict says, quote, "If we wish to dwell in the tent of God's kingdom, we will never arrive unless we run there doing good deeds." That seems to set it pretty clearly that we will reach the kingdom by doing good deeds. But later in the same rule, he said, "These people who do the good deeds fear the Lord and do not become elated over their good deeds. They judge it as the Lord's power, not as their own, that brings about the good in them. They praise the Lord in working in them and say as the prophet, 'Not to us, O Lord, not to us give glory, but to your name alone.'" There is a sense of grace, Dr. Calhoun says, in that statement. But I think the principle in our study, particularly in the study of doctrine, is that with the emphasis comes the theology. Your emphasis will become your theology. If you read the whole rule and much of the writings of the monks, the emphasis is certainly on the idea that you must do good works to inherit the kingdom of heaven. Grace is there, but it tends to be placed in a less prominent position. The same thing happens in the Christian life today. When you talk about good works, you talk about works of faith, you talk about the thing that the Lord, you talk about keeping the commandments of the Lord, which His children will do. As we heard through our pastor's presentations through Galatians, you then begin to look at the keeping of the commandments as the thing that assures your sanctification. We're smart enough to know it doesn't do our salvation, but we begin to think that our sanctification is secured by our good works. Works and grace are always a problem. It's always a tension and ever will be in the Christian life. Benedict talked about the grace coming from God, but he talked about works, and the emphasis was works. So from monasticism, you have salvation by works. You can't deny that that did happen. But one of the good things that I had over here, the missions, especially in the East, we can see in the next 9 minutes a spread of Christianity that was not in the Roman Empire. In the East, in Persia, let me get the map up here. All right, this area is present-day Turkey, Asia Minor. This is Palestine. This is Israel, of course, obviously, today. This is Syria. This is Iran. This is Iraq. This area here became very populated by Christians. One of the first that we'll talk about is Jacob of Nisibis. Jacob was an ascetic. He was a kind of a monk. Monasticism was very popular in the East. But Jacob returned to the world, just like Basil and some others did, to serve the church. He left his cell in the wilderness. He went back to the world. He went back to the church. He returned to the church rather than staying. He returned to the church. He became the first bishop of Nisibis. And we think that he was even present at the Council of Nicaea in 325. The church was alive in the East. A second Christian from that period in that era was Aphrodite the Persian. Did I say that right? Aphrodite? Whatever. He was the greatest Eastern theologian of the 4th century. He carried on kind of a continual dialogue with the Jews. Judaism was very strong in this area because of the dispersion. Judaism was up there and they remained strong. Minority, but strong. His dialogue with the Jews is very thoughtful. Dr. Moffat has several pages on him here in the History of Christianity in Asia. His greatest writing was called The Demonstrations. Dr. Moffat says the Demonstrations are, quote, "a remarkable blend of straightforward biblical teachings with deep and disciplined personal piety." I'll mention him again in just a minute. Ephrem the Syrian is the best known of the Eastern Asian theologians and Bible expositors. and hymn writer. It's interesting that many of the Eastern leaders, theologians, were also hymn writers. They believed in writing hymns. Ephraim said, "Scripture brought me to the gate of paradise, and the mind stood still in wonder as it entered." He was amazed at God's mercy, amazed at God's grace, and he wrote hymns to that effect. Before we leave this area of Persia, though, and the church in the East, I have to mention the great persecution that occurred around 390. The great persecution came about because the ruler in the East, whose name I think was, starts with an S, but he was a second. Anyway, there would had always been conflict between Rome, the Roman Empire, and the Persian Empire. Sometimes Rome could extend its control to these areas. Sometimes Rome was defeated. Around 390, the emperor of the East heard that Afrite the Persian was teaching with his interpretation of end times that the beast from the west would destroy the beast from the east, and that Rome ultimately would prevail. And he says, "Hey, these people are living in my kingdom and they're pulling for the other side." The pressure becomes so intense that it's estimated that 190,000 Christians lost their life over the next 10 years. It's interesting that the impetus for that was a misinterpretation of prophecy. In the 4th century, someone was thinking that this was happening. When someone tells you today that they're seeing prophetic signs, save the electricity, cut off your TV. It's garbage. Absolute, unalterated garbage. They are not seeing prophetic signs. Ain't happening. The Lord's coming back. Glory to God. But John Hagee, or no one else, is seeing the signs of that. They're not building the Western Wall. Forget it. Ain't happening. Not now. They thought it was happening in the 4th century, one of these things, 5th century. Throughout the history of the church, we'll see misapplication of prophetic teaching. Spread of Christianity in Africa. Ah, this is good. This comes out of Mark Shaw's Kingdom of God in Africa, which I requested for Christmas for my daughter because it was so expensive. I figured it's $46 for that little paperback. But I thought I was worth it. And I told her if she's going to buy me something else, might as well buy me something I need. Axum or Ethiopia. This map shows you the location of Ethiopia. This is an outline of the country of Ethiopia today. Axum was an old name of Ethiopia. Christianity entered Ethiopia, or Axum, it was called that day, through the court. By the 4th century, in the year 330, the king of Axum was converted to Christianity. This was just a few years after Constantine was converted. The first coin that you can find that has explicit Christian symbols on it was a coin that was minted in the kingdom of Axum. Before Constantine ever put a cross on anything, the king of Axum did in the coin that he minted. Christianity was spread to the countryside of Ethiopia in the 5th century, largely through the efforts of Syrian missionaries. Now you think, isn't Syria a long way? But just imagine, now here's Syria. The missionaries could just cross the Red Sea, and they were in this area. There was a lot of going back and forth across the Red Sea. So the influence from Syria was great. The Syrian missionaries carried Christianity. Gibbon, in his book on the Roman Empire, said, quote, "Christianity, they slept near 1,000 years, forgetful of the world by whom they were forgotten." Well, that's kind of an overstatement, but Christianity remained in Ethiopia for a long time, and we will revisit that in the coming lectures. Well, that was just another showing you the area of modern-day Ethiopia. The Erythia did not exist then, but you see how close it would be to that period. The second part of Africa that was converted to Christianity was what they called Nubia which is the modern day Sudan. Egypt is up here, Sudan is below it. This is the whole area that they considered Nubia. Christianity came to Nubia not through the court, through the king, but through the poor. The Christianity moved from the poor people into the court. By the 6th century, there was a solid Christian church in Nubia. I wish I could say it continued to exist, but it literally was wiped out with the Muslim storm from the east that came a century later. The church in Ethiopia, though, did continue to exist. Christianity is not a Roman thing. It's not a Western thing. It was in the areas of the known world and the world that was not even known by the common man. Christianity was going, making inroads, and establishing itself. Well, we've got 2 minutes. Any questions before we finish or comments? Yes, brother.
The church remained in Ethiopia when all around it was Muslim.
Well, it's an element of the church did remain there. I mean, it stayed alive. Maybe the Muslims, even though they took over the part of Ethiopia that we would consider closer, let's get back to the map. You know, the Muslims took over this area. Maybe the church was able to survive down in the areas less populated. I don't know, but it did exist. Also, there was a Jewish community in Ethiopia that continued to exist. And even today, there is a black Jewish community in Ethiopia. Now, did the church come out of that? You can't show any line that it did. But there are black Jews in Ethiopia even to today. Phil?
Dale, I don't remember if you mentioned this last time, but these guys that like to sit up on the pillars.
Stalites,
Yeah.
Simeon the Stalite.
Did they stay there all the time?
Well, it says that they did. I don't know how they stayed there all the time. I don't have any idea, just like I don't know how they were baptized without their clothes on. There are certain things that the text just doesn't, you know, tell you everything about. I can't work out the details of that, but supposedly they stayed there 24/7. Phil?
When did the Nestorians appear?
The Nestorians appeared right now in the 4th and 5th century. The Nestorians is what you call the church in the East. You call it Nestorian Christianity.
They went all the way over into China.
Oh, yes, the Nestorians were definitely in China. The church extends all the way to India. It extends all the way to China. And as we go through periods of church history, we will talk about the Nestorians. The Nestorians, by the way, get a bum rap in some circles. But Dr. Moffat, who is the authority on the church in Asia, gives the Nestorians a few more check marks than some other people have done. Thank you for your attention.